Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your show host. In Oregon's Josephine County, voters turned down a local tax measure that would have restored funding to the county's public safety agencies, including the sheriff's office. That has left citizens with reduced law enforcement patrols. In response, armed citizens have organized their own patrols.
We're trying to be proactive. We're trying to show the bad guys that we're out there in force and they better watch out.
Leah Moriarty reports on the armed groups stepping up to fill the gaps. That story coming up in 5 minutes. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Rural counties in southern Oregon are suffering from the loss of federal timber money that used to be the mainstay of county government budgets. After repeated failed efforts to get residents to approve tax increases, officials in Josephine County made dramatic cutbacks in county services, including law enforcement. In response, a growing number of armed citizen groups are cropping up to fill that public safety vacuum. From Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Liam Moriarty reports.
It's after 10 p.m. as Sam Nichols and Alan Kress slowly cruise through the tiny town of O'Brien, shining super bright spotlights into the shadows.
We're just checking this commercial building here just to make sure there's no one hiding around it or anything.
Nichols' King Cab pickup has a yellow flasher on top and signs on the doors identifying it as a Citizens Against Crime patrol.
We're trying to be proactive. We're trying to show the bad guys that we're out there in force and they better watch out.
Alan Kress says the nightly armed patrols are meant to be an extra set of eyes and ears to deter criminal activity.
We're not trying to play cops and robbers or take the place of law enforcement. In fact, we have a great deal of respect for what law enforcement does. We recognize the limited resources they have, and we're just trying to keep a presence out there.
You might think out in the country like this, there's not much crime to speak of. But high unemployment and a growing drug problem, plus the sudden lack of law enforcement, has fed a growth in burglaries, vehicle thefts, and other property crimes. Nichols says the patrols have made a difference in O'Brien.
There were 5 major thefts, travel trailers, automobiles, tractors, this sort of thing, before we started patrolling. Since we've started patrolling, there hasn't been a single one.
For decades, revenue from timber sales on the federal land that makes up 70% of Josephine County kept property taxes low and the county government functioning. As logging dramatically declined, those payments dried up. Things came to a head in 2012.
We went from a $12 million budget to a $5.2 million budget.
Josephine County Sheriff Gil Gilbertson.
We reduced our workforce from, I think we had 98 down to 34, so 65% of our personnel were laid off.
At one point, Gilbertson was forced to release dozens of inmates from the county jail as he downsized to meet reduced staffing levels. He was left with a single deputy to patrol the entire county. Police officers in Grants Pass, the county seat, had no choice but to cut petty criminals loose because there was nowhere to put them.
Right now, the only thing the sheriff's office provides really is if you have a life-threatening situation, they will come out.
That's Ken Selig. He lives in the small town of Merlin. Until May 2012, Selig was a 33-year veteran of the sheriff's department. Faced with being laid off, Selig retired, but he says it quickly became obvious that the cutbacks had left the vacuum in which criminals grew bolder. He points to an incident where an elderly neighbor came home to find her door forced open. When she called the sheriff's department, she was told that unless she was sure there was somebody still in the house, no one would respond. Selig and former reserve deputy Pete Scaglione gathered other concerned neighbors and formed North Valley Community Watch.
So we started to train, and I used the same lesson plans, the same things that when I taught at the academy.
What we're going to do tonight is basically practice some room entries.
On a weekday evening, Selig stands before a classroom whiteboard in a civic building in Merlin. He's preparing members of the North Valley Community Watch responder team for a training exercise. They're going to practice how to approach and clear a building where an intruder may be hiding. After making certain their sidearms are unloaded, the group breaks down into small teams to search the building. Guns drawn, team members cautiously maneuver down the hallway, learning how to move as a coordinated unit.
Neighborhood watch! Police are on their way! Show us your hands!
Selig says the group limits itself to doing what the sheriff's department no longer does.
We go and we clear homes and businesses. We respond to trespassers. We respond to suspicious people in the neighborhood. And we create a presence there.
The group also maintains a website and Facebook page where locals report thefts or sightings of suspicious activity. There are at least two other communities in the county with similar citizen safety groups, one in Cave Junction and another south of Grants Pass. Sheriff Gil Gilbertson says he supports neighborhood watch groups and that citizen involvement is crucial, especially in remote rural areas. But he worries things could get out of hand. He recalls a community meeting he attended.
And the gentleman that's sitting right next to me kept repeating, "We're not going to hire any more of you guys. We're not going to pay for you because we can do this ourselves." Well, that really concerns me. That does concern me.
Next month, Josephine County voters will have another chance to approve a property tax hike to restore the public safety budget. Two previous levies have failed. But members of the citizen groups in both Merlin and O'Brien say they found a new sense of civic involvement and self-reliance. And even if the sheriff's department returns to full funding, they say, they'll continue protecting their communities. I'm Liam Moriarty, reporting.
In Washington, timber dollars are playing politics in a different way. As fundraising for this November's election is kicking into high gear, candidates are cozying up to people with money. Sometimes elected officials even get friendly with the companies they regulate. From Seattle, John Ryan reports.
I'm standing outside the 2 Union Building in downtown Seattle. Up on the 31st floor right now, there's a reception going on. It's in the offices of the Plum Creek Timber Company. No reporters allowed. It's a fundraiser for Congresswoman Susan Del Bene, with a special guest appearance by Oregon Congressman Peter DeFazio. He's the ranking Democrat of the House Natural Resources Committee. Suggested contributions range from $1,000 to $5,000. Co-hosts of the event are Washington Lands Commissioner Peter Goldmark and the Plum Creek and Weyerhaeuser Political Action Committees. Those are two of the timber companies that Goldmark regulates as head of the Washington Department of Natural Resources. Goldmark canceled his appearance at the last minute. His assistant said he was ill.
Goldmark's relationship with the industry he oversees has changed since the Democrat first ran for lands commissioner 6 years ago. Back then, Goldmark campaigned against the DNR's poor management of logging on landslide-prone slopes in southwest Washington.
A lack of appropriate oversight, and I will change that. I will make sure that public health and safety is a very important component of approval of all timber harvest permits, particularly where there are steep slopes involved. We need to exercise that authority to make sure that downstream property owners and downstream lives are not at risk.
The state's timber industry spent some $700,000 trying to keep Goldmark out of office. Goldmark attacked his Republican predecessor, Doug Sutherland, and his reliance on industry cash.
Over half of his campaign money comes from the very industries that he's charged with regulating. And I think that produces a distinct conflict of interest. I will not accept money from the industries that I'll be regulating.
Campaign finance records show Goldmark kept his pledge in 2008. But in his re-election bid in 2012, Goldmark took in at least $80,000 from the timber industry. That was about 15% of his campaign funding.
It's true. I pledged not to take any campaign contributions during the 2008 campaign. In 2012, I did not make such a pledge.
Do you see any problem with accepting contributions from industries that you regulate?
No, I do not. I'm proud of the fact that I was supported by many, many different interest groups. And regardless of who supports me, I will continue to work for the public.
Many environmentalists backed Goldmark for office, but some have lost their enthusiasm since the deadly Oso landslide in March. A small portion of the no-logging area around that landslide zone had been clear-cut back in 2004. That was when Doug Sutherland was still the head of DNR. Environmentalists have wondered why Goldmark has dismissed any questioning of the role logging might have played in that landslide as inappropriate or even trying to exploit a tragedy.
He seems to be hinting that we shouldn't be concerned.
Mitch Friedman is executive director of Conservation Northwest and a Goldmark campaign contributor.
If Commissioner Goldmark said, look, the relationship of logging and landslides is complicated, and the history of OSO is complicated, but we're going to do our best to get the bottom of it, and we're going to try and do our best to protect public safety. I think we'd all be fine with that.
It took the Department of Natural Resources about 6 years to get to the bottom of the 2007 landslides in southwest Washington. The agency completed the second of two big studies of the slides just last year. That's 5 years after Goldmark made campaign hay of the slides in 2008. I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
The Columbia River will remain drawn down, at least until June, because of the cracked Wanapum Dam in southeast Washington. That means fish can't reach their traditional ladders. Engineers are working on a fix, but this week, hundreds of Chinook salmon were rounded up and loaded into tanker trucks to hitch a ride around the problem. Correspondent Anna King has the story.
I'm at Wanapum Dam, where engineers are working on extensions and water slides of sorts to get fish ladders working again. But work to install this new equipment has been difficult, with cranes, man baskets, and the whipping Columbia River wind. Thomas Stredwick is with Grant County Utility District.
You're up here right now, and it's kind of a nice, cool breeze. But imagine it with 60, 70 mile an hour gusts, and workers in man lifts and trying to haul equipment around. You can see how in pretty short order things can get pretty dicey.
Workers are installing massive steel structures with wooden slides to help the fish over the dam. There's a brewing storm coming upriver if it doesn't work. This crew could start to see 12,000 fish collecting per day at the dam in the peak of summer. Already, some early migrating fish are forcing a short-term solution that could turn into something longer. At Priest Rapids Dam, about 20 miles down the Columbia River, Grant County Utility District workers are trapping these early migrators so they can be trucked around the dam.
Hey, hold on, Kyle.
Trucks like this one will fill up with thousands of gallons of river water and about 150 fish per load.
It's unthinkable for anybody in the state that we wouldn't get a salmon run up the river.
That's Jeff Porth. He looks a bit like Wyatt Earp with his Eastern Washington handlebar mustache. He's a major fish manager for Washington's Fish and Wildlife. At the peak of the fish run, Porth's crew and Grant County Utility District employees could be moving about 1,500 fish a day. They're all hoping that engineers and construction crews can finish fixes on Wanapum and Rock Island Dam soon so they won't have to truck as many fish.
One thing that's not fortuitous is that first run of salmon just happens to be the spring Chinook, and they are the endangered. They're the most endangered fish we have up here. And so we're going to have to deal with the most critical population right out of the gate.
Porth worries that even with the best plans in engineering, working with salmon is still unpredictable.
That falls under the category that I call never put anything past a fish. You know, if you're absolutely sure they won't do something, they'll end up doing it.
And if the modified ladder systems don't work by the time the larger summer run arrives, Porth says,
we'd have to make some very hard decisions. But we're pretty optimistic we're not going to get there.
Because to do it by hand would be insurmountable, you think?
The logistics of hauling something like close to 500,000 fish would be pretty difficult.
Porth says inept ladders would probably mean deciding which runs of salmon to save. Porth says a lot of engineering, policy, and sweat's gone into getting salmon past the cracked dam. We won't know for at least a few weeks whether all this work will pay off. I'm Anna King near Mattawa.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, throughout the country, ordinary citizens contribute to National Weather Service forecasts during extreme weather events. But first, they get training in making accurate descriptions and measurements from Weather Service instructors.
we go over all those hazards, and then you know how to report that. How do you measure the snowfall and report that? How do you report hail if it's falling in your neighborhood?
The National Weather Service's Tyree Wild explains the volunteer severe weather spotter program coming up just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region today. Rain with increasing wind velocities, southwest 5 to 10 miles per hour, increasing to 10 to 15 miles per hour, and gusting to 25 miles per hour this afternoon. High temperatures in the mid-50s. Tonight, mostly cloudy with showers likely this evening. A chance of showers overnight. Overnight lows in the low 40s. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says a weak high pressure builds over the area tomorrow, so look for some sun during the day, along with slightly warmer temperatures into Sunday. Saturday night, we could see an increased chance of showers with another weak system near the area, but the models are not all consistent for Sunday into the start of next week. Indications now are for a mostly cloudy forecast with a chance of showers Sunday and Monday. Highs continue in the high 50s, lows around the mid 40s. The National Weather Service will be conducting severe weather spotter classes this month in Nehalem Bay and next month in Cannon Beach. Earlier, I spoke with National Weather Service meteorologist Tyree Wild about the program and how to participate.
Good morning, Tyree. Thanks for talking with us here at Coast Community Radio.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you doing this morning?
I am doing good. I'd like to talk about a program our listeners can take part in where volunteers contribute to National Weather Service reports. Severe weather events are something we regularly experience in our coastal communities, so we really watch and listen to weather reports and updates. We regularly broadcast weather forecasts from the National Weather Service in Portland, and what a lot of people might not know about the service is in that in times of extreme weather events such as high winds, forecasters look to eyes on the ground for accurate reports of what could be happening in a very small local area. And some of those eyes on the ground are trained volunteer severe weather spotters. Tyree, could you explain the Skywarn Severe Weather Spotter Program and the importance of the volunteers to the program?
We actually have a network of, like you alluded to, trained volunteer weather spotters. And really what they help out is they help us out in our warning program in that they're the eyes and the ears in the local community, if you will. So we meteorologists over here in our office, you know, we have lots of equipment to kind of look at information, satellite data, radar data, the buoy data, and kind of get an idea of, hey, we've got a strong storm coming in. Looks like this could produce high winds or could produce snow or even, you know, in the case of maybe a rare thunderstorm and some type of hail. But we really don't know what's happening in the local community, like down in Astoria, what's really falling on the ground. Boy, the radar's telling us that we might have some pretty good, maybe some hail coming in that, but we need that confirmation on the ground of, oh, yeah, the hail is a penny size or the hail is a nickel size. Or yeah, we just had a sign blow off of the gas station down here in Nehalem. So those, to get those eyewitness reports in the local communities, we've actually instigated a program called the Volunteer Storm Spotter Program. So we go out in the communities a couple of times a year when we train people that want to do this service for their community, and we train them on how to observe different types of weather and then how to report that to us here in the National Weather Service. And once we can get that information of what's happening in the community, the eyewitness reports, if you will, what's happening in the communities, and we can kind of integrate that into our warning reports, into our warning statements, such as, we have issued a severe thunderstorm warning, for instance, for the North Oregon coast. And, oh, by the way, a trained storm spotter down in Nehalem is reporting nickel-sized hail with this particular storm. So that really kind of helps the local community to kind of understand, oh, yeah, that they're seeing some severe weather, and my neighbor up the street is actually seeing it at his house. So it kind of just fills in those gaps and gives us those eyes and the ears in the community, and these volunteer weather spotters, that they're providing a service for their community, too.
There are a couple of the training sessions coming up on our area. Now, these are one-time, approximately two-hour sessions. And what can volunteers expect to learn?
Yeah, so we come up in the communities, and we, like you said, we've got a couple of training sessions come up here in the next couple of weeks. So it takes about an hour and a half to an hour to come to the session, and it's free of charge. And so you get to come and learn a little bit about severe weather. So we talk about, you know, high winds. What type of storms create high winds? How do thunderstorms grow? And the hazards associated with thunderstorms like lightning, hail, or strong winds. And maybe even the storms produce heavy rain and potential flooding or snowstorms. And then we go over all those hazards. And then, you know, how to report that. How do you measure the snowfall and report that? How do you report hail if it's falling in your neighborhood? You know, a lot of people think, well, just it looks like BBs or it looks like marbles, but we actually train people to, hey, you can equate this to a coin size, and it's a pretty standard method of reporting that type of hail. Or how much rain did you have in your area, and things of that nature. So basically, how to identify different severe weather signatures, and then how to what the reporting criteria is. So we certainly have reporting criteria that kind of matches aligns along with our warning program, but also aligns with some of the impacts we've typically seen in the communities.
So everybody's on the same page with regards to what's being reported.
Exactly, and usually when the reporting we're hitting some type of really close to some type of threshold that can be impacting to the community.
How often do you call the weather spotters?
Well, there's a couple ways we can do things. That's a really good question because there's a couple ways we can. So once they're trained, we can get their information of how to contact them, and we can call them on the phone, such as, for instance, hey, this is the weather service over here in Portland. Looks like we see a strong storm headed your way or just moved over your house. Can you tell us kind of what happened? So that's that one way. Or they can actually call us. We give them information of how to call us on a 1-800 telephone number, and they can report that information. Or we've also started using some new technologies now, that we can take that information and they can report that information through a web browser, through the internet. We have a storm spotting web page. They can just actually go quickly fill out that form and then send it to us that way, and we receive it via the web. And we can also use social media. They can report that to us through Twitter or Facebook, on our Twitter or Facebook page, and we can receive it that way. So we're trying to embrace and use all these different technologies. And social media has actually proved to be a very good method to find out what's happening in the communities, because we can actually, once we get our spotters trained and they know what to look for and what criteria it is, they can actually just go to our our Facebook page or our Twitter feed and actually just put that information in there, and then we get it and everybody in their community gets it too.
Well, speaking of online developments, you have a relatively new wrinkle to the training program. It looks like there will be a live online session at the end of this month, and how can people participate in that?
Yeah, there sure is, and that will be on April 29th. That particular, we call it a virtual spotter training. So, you know, for many, many years, we've come out in the community and maybe had the training in the fire station or at the local community building or something like that. And we still do that, and that's a really good way for us to get to know our spotters and get to know the community. But, you know, not everybody can make those sessions, so we've again, kind of employed some technology to where we can actually have people sit in the comfort of their living room and tune us up under their computer, and we can actually do a virtual training session. So it's done by a virtual webinar, if you will. We have a piece of software here that we can kind of bring up our course, if you are a spotter training course, and have somebody teach the course virtually, and then if you sign up for that course, there'll be a location where you can go to a web page and a phone number to call, and you can just sit in the comfort of your home and actually go through this training virtually by having the instructor back here at our office, but you're sitting at home at your couch or at your kitchen table or in your office getting the training. So it's pretty much the same level of training, maybe not quite as long. We've shortened it a little bit just to make sure that kind of people can sit down for about an hour and get the essential part of the training. So that's a new method that they can also get the training.
If you want to participate in the online version of the training, how do you sign up for that?
Yeah, you can go to our webpage at weather.gov/Portland, and there's a section on that webpage in the Skywarn section, that's what we call our program, and you'll be able to find that how to sign up for that particular class.
Well, thank you for sharing this information, and a thank you, National Weather Service meteorologist Tyree Wild, for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, and thanks for having me on your show.
The next training in our area will be Thursday, April 24th at the Nehalem Bay Fire and Rescue Headquarters, 36375 Highway 101 North. The online training takes place Tuesday, April 29th at 7 p.m. Then next month, another in-person training will be held at Cannon Beach Fire and Rescue, 188 Sunset Boulevard. Links to information about the trainings can be found on our website, coastradio.org. Just click the news button on the home page. That's all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at kmun.org. I'm Kathleen Morgain saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.